everyone, and welcome to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Adam Verrier, your host today, and today we're going to talk about Kincaid Park. It's a place that I go a lot. I've been ever since I've lived in Anchorage for the past 30 years. Kincaid Park is a place that I go probably 3, 4, 5 days a week, sometimes every day. We've got great ski trails at Kincaid Park. There's great places to go for a run. You can take your visitors out here from out of town and see moose. But Kincaid Park was started, I believe, as a ski trail system. And I wanted to find out more about the history of this park and how the park began. And for that, I've come to Jim and Sally Burkholder's house, which is on the edge of the park. And Jim and Sally Burkholder were instrumental in getting this park turned into what it is today, especially in the very early days. And so I'm sitting here with Jim Burkholder in his kitchen. And welcome to Outdoor Explorer, Jim. Thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thanks, Adam. Glad to talk about Kincaid Park.
So the first thing that is obvious about Kincaid Park, when if you go out there, if you look around at all, you can see that there's a lot of concrete out there. Before Kincaid Park, apparently this park, it wasn't always a park. What was the use, what was the area used for before it became a park?
Kincaid Park was the headquarters site for the U.S. military's ground-to-air missile, Nike missiles that they were using in the late 40s and 60s. And there were three sites around the Anchorage area. One was at Site Summit up by Arctic Valley. Then there was another site over at Goose Bay. And then the headquarters site was at Kincaid. And they started building the military site in the early 50s. And as you say, they poured a lot of concrete. Some of the round dome buildings you see and the drive to the stadium area on your right. The club has one for a bunker and then the other one is a storage area for the municipality. The walls in that thing are 18 inches thick. The steel doors are about 10 inches thick. And these were where they stored the warheads. It's debatable, and not to my knowledge, whether you say it's a Nike Hercules, but I don't think they were using nuclear warheads. At least They've never admitted it.
Right, they never told you about it. And they'd wheel them right out of those buildings. And you see the rails, I guess. They just wheel them out of the buildings and fire them off if they needed to.
And at Kincaid, it was a double site, so you've got actually four buildings with two missiles in each building. And they were on a kind of railroad rails. The doors would open, roll up, and they're still in place. And the other three buildings beside the, when they converted the one of the buildings to the Kincaid Outdoor Center in the early 80s. And there, you know, if you'd have seen what the build or what this site looked like in the late 60s and 70s, you'd have thought it was nothing but a prison. There was two 12-foot chain link fences that went around the entire site. One of the outer fence was actually the bottom foot was in the ground and cement had been poured so that you could keep the rabbits and other things out. And they had guards with dogs that would patrol between the two fences. And there was only one entrance road with a guard gate, and there was three or four guard towers at approximately the corner of the particular site. And it was a city unto itself. You had about 350 military personnel sited up in what we term today the World Cup start-finish area. And it had its own power plant, heating plant. There was a well that connected all the buildings for water purposes. The heat was a steam plant for the four bunkers and the heat plant and several other headquarters buildings down there. So it was quite a complex. And they had a, you know, with that much personnel, there was a lot of sewage to get rid of. And there was a 6-inch sewer line that ran from the World Cup all the way down and through the complex. They had a 50,000 gallon septic tank. And then that then drained down and out at Point Campbell. And effectively, those lines are still in the ground.
Huh. Yeah, I didn't know that there was still that much infrastructure out there, or that it was that, that there was that much infrastructure. You grew up in Anchorage, so that site was running when you were growing up in Anchorage. That's what was going on out there.
Right. I grew up in Anchorage, as you say. I was in the eighth grade at Central Junior High, which is effectively where the Performing Arts Center is today. And the school district had 7, 8, and 9 in junior high, and only had one high school at that time, and that's was Anchorage High School, which today is West. And the 10, 11, 12 grade went to West High School. And it was a fairly big school. When I graduated, I think it was a graduating class of about 540 or 50 people.
Yeah, that's pretty
good. And I graduated in 61, and they were building East High and opened it in the spring of 61.
Well, speaking of schools, you went off to college, Western State College, came back after college, and you were a school teacher at the time. Is that right? You went directly into school teaching out of college.
I did. Graduated. It took me 5 years to go through college. I skied for Western State College, and when I came back in 67, the fall of 67, I started teaching at Diamond Mears, which was the third high school that was built in Anchorage. When I started teaching, I was also the cross-country ski coach. And that first and second year when I was teaching, we had, once again, this was 7, 8, and 9, we had over 100 kids in on the junior high ski team.
Wow, even back then. I had no idea that you had so many skiers back in those days. What made that so popular among kids to be on the ski team? Was it just, you skied out behind the school?
Yeah, the Diamond at the time didn't have many buildings around it. It was private land, and then it was somewhat subdivided. And we built a trail that went out of the school and across this private land and down to the Campbell Creek and alongside, at least the north side of Campbell Creek, up probably as far as our Arctic Boulevard is today. And of course that was a wetlands and so forth. And skiing at that time was just only classic, and you only needed 3.5-4 foot wide trail with and it was pretty rough. It wasn't smooth. Most of the way we set tracks in those days is we did it on skis. Mm-hmm. And first person to go and ski, and the next person would be have his right foot in the left track, and just kind of a V shape, and you'd have four people or six people like that, and with 100 kids skiing over it, you had a pretty hard you know, track.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say 100. It was easier to do it with about 20 or so kids. But that's one of the ways we packed the trails.
And so that was in the, like, 67, 68, 69, kind of in that at that time.
Yes, that was.
And at the time then, Kincaid was still a military installation, but that was coming to an end, I guess, in the late 60s.
It was more in the, I think they gave up the site in 79, but what was happening was that around Diamond, after the first 3 or 4 years, a lot of houses were built, and we lost the access down to Campbell Creek, and I'd had to look around, and I thought to myself, well, is there another Russian Jack? Because at that time, that was the city's largest park. And I looked around, and lo and behold, there was a Kincaid Park. And so I did a little bit of research, and in 1971, the fall of 71, and we decided that this would be the best place that we could take the ski team, the high school ski team at this point, and go ski, because but there was a lot of confusion on who owned what particular land in what was called Kincaid Park at that particular time, because it was a much, much smaller area than what it is today. Mm. And the reason for the move was we lost the trail in the fall of 71, and we went to what is today Little Campbell Lake. At the time, it was called Beer Can Lake. And the reason was that when you have 350 young military types at that particular site, that was their party site.
Oh, because that was not on base. That was off the base then.
That was off the base.
Okay.
And in fact, it is part of what is the airport lands, and the airport, Anchorage International Airport, state of Alaska, actually owns the land underneath Little Campbell Lake. Even to this day, the city has a use agreement with them for recreational purposes, for the trails, as well as the summer activities in the lake, everything from swimming, boating to you know, that's the type of activity that takes place. And so the Kincaid portion in 1971 was basically along John First Street today. And the other thing that was in the park at that time, where the Jodhpur parking lot is, and more importantly, where the motocross area is that is used in the summer, was at that time the borough car dump. Because in 71, you had two governmental agencies in Anchorage. One was the borough, which would be sort of the county and the rural areas, and the other was the city of Anchorage itself. And so you had two governmental agencies. You had a mayor for the Anchorage borough, and you had a mayor for the Anchorage city. And it wasn't until the middle of the 1970s where they really got serious about combining the two and forming one city, thus getting rid of, you know, some of the bureaucrats and so forth. And Kincaid area was in the borough. And it was a fairly small, you know, governmental agency. And anyway, this is where people would dump off cars, and they had a contractor. He'd strip the cars, empty the oil out of them, and you have the sand dunes in that particular area where the motocross is. And what they were doing was shoving those cars right off the edge of the bluff.
And you can still see them down there.
Yeah,
some of them have still see some fins sticking out of the sand down there.
Yeah, you can. And what they did is when they closed it, they took a big cat. And the reason the sand dunes are there is because they cleared all the vegetation off and plowed it over and covered up those cars.
So that area then was part of Kincaid Park before the decommissioning of the military site then.
Yep.
And so was the area around Beer Can or Little Campbell Lake. That was all park previously, I guess.
Right.
And so it sounds like the decommissioning of the Nike missile launch site was only one part in the opening up of that park to its current use.
Yeah, the way when 71, when we went to the area around Little Campbell Lake to ski during that first winter, the airport had just a couple years previously had put up the fence that's on the south side of the airport. And they'd cleared off an area that was about 40 foot wide, and they'd put up their fence for to keep wildlife out and rambunctious kids, I suppose. And we, that first winter, that's where we skied. We skied on the lake, we skied alongside the fence, on the south side of the fence. And then the Federal Communication Commission had a big site that is on the right, just as you enter the park. And they had big antenna fields in that particular area. And the Radio Club of Alaska has the building that was their headquarters today. And as you drive into the park, that's a building that is on the right-hand side. And we skied out underneath the communication towers there and as well as on the French line. And that was the first winter. In the summer of 72, Dick Mize and John Elliott, myself, and several other club members, and Betsy Tower, Leo Hannon, who were the president of the Nordic Ski Club, got permission from the borough to develop some ski trails on Kincaid Park land. And we assumed at that time that the lake was part of the park.
Mm. But it was actually airport land.
But it was much later we found out that it was airport land. And that's how that in the first summer of 72, we started building trails, and we built about 5 kilometers of trail using the lake as a start finish. And of course, it was cold enough, a little colder back in those days than it is today, but just like people use Westchester Lagoon for ice skating, we were out there and starting races on the lake. And it was, in 72, it was the most developed, and as far as ski terrain is concerned, it had more vertical rise and fall than Russian Jack did, because Russian Jack is mainly pretty flat.
Yeah.
And so that was a area that we, developed that first year of 72, in the summer of 72. And we kept expanding. The following summer, 73, we put a trail across where the bridge is, and basically developed the what is called today the Jodhpur Loop. And then 74, 75, we started working on the trail system that went further to the west, which goes down into Icebox and over where the wall comes back up the hill to Icebox, or excuse me, to the Jodhpur Trail. And then, you know, as we were developing those particular areas, we actually even developed a little or some of the trails on military land because they weren't using or even patrolling it. Plus, by then, 75, 76, there was a movement for the military to give up the land. And it had already been back in the 50s, early 50s, when the military took that land over, it was agreed that it was go back to the local government. And in this case, it was still the borough, but the city and the borough were in the process of eliminating the and becoming one governmental entity,
right,
which was something that occurred, I think it was in about 78, so forth, when that occurred.
Okay. I want to interrupt you real quick and just let listeners know that they're listening to Outdoor Explorer. And my name is Adam Verrier. I'm your host, and I'm speaking with Jim Burkholder, or Berkey as his friends, and I know him. Jim Burkholder, who was instrumental in one of the key guys in getting this park sort of established.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. My name is Adam Verrier. I'm your host, and I'm speaking with Jim Burkholder, or Berkey as his friends, and I know him. Jim Burkholder, who was instrumental in one of the key guys in getting this park sort of established. We were at about 1975, 1976.
And of course, there were still the military was still there and still occupying the site, and we were doing our skiing and the eastern half of the park. We actually developed a little start finish area that is just a little on the south side of the entrance road and a little east of the present bridge where it is. Where we had our start and finish, and of course,
really, I guess I didn't know about that because that's all grown in now.
Yeah, it's all grown in and it's kind of reshaped a little bit. It's.
Did you have a little parking area there or something, or?
Well, most people were just parking on the side of the road.
Oh,
parking was always a problem when we had a race. People would park beside the road, and it was practically a one-lane road all the way out from Beer Can Lake, because that parking lot's pretty small.
And another question I have, I guess, for you right now, this is probably the time to ask it, is you started most events in at the very beginning, they all started down there at Beer Can Lake or Little Campbell Lake. Did you then start having most of the events at the Jodhpur parking lot, or did the Jodhpur parking lot come much later?
The Jodhpur parking lot didn't come about. We had our trail, and the trail didn't go into the area where the borough car dump was. And the trail that we developed is still in evidence right there by Berkey's bend in the Jodhpur Trail. And there's a little kind of, you look to the right, there's a little road, and that runs back and connects back into the Jodhpur Trail. And everything that would have been south of that towards the parking lot was basically the operation. I think it was a private contractor that was stripping cars and doing his thing.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't until probably 75 before we started using that area, as well as if it was a big event or race, we'd be on the lake because we needed that.
Yeah. Okay.
That space.
And how did these trails? You've told us that we built these trails here, and then we expanded out into here, and then we built a couple more trails. Who was involved in building these trails and figuring out where they would go and who was out there with? Were you running any heavy equipment to get these trails going, or was it a lot more chainsaw work and shovels?
Well, it was. You have to realize that the trails today are in most cases 20 feet wide. The ski trails. Here at Kincaid Park. At that time, we were only talking classic skiing, and the trails were 7 to 8 feet wide, and the reason for that is that when we started developing these trails, it was all volunteer, and we got the use of a few pieces of equipment, mainly a small cat with an 8-foot blade, and we'd borrow that for a couple of weeks and put the trail in. And that's how those particular trails were developed. And with a trail that wide, then the club ended up having to start to mechanically groom the trails because it was impossible to do it, you know, in the old fashion. And of course, snow machines back in that era were, they were there, but they were pretty crude. They didn't run very well.
Yeah, right.
And,
and so they got stuck a lot.
And you got stuck a lot.
Yeah.
they couldn't get them started.
Right.
And you had to invent your own grooming equipment that you pulled behind it. And by, I think it was 78, we'd finally convinced the city that they needed to hire a groomer. And they put out a private contract, and they hired a private groomer, and he bought a 8-foot wide, what was then called a Bob the Deer 200, which was basically a swamp buggy type vehicle. This Gene Mimack was the fellow's name, and he welded up a drag that he could cradle on the back of that, put it on a trailer, and he drove it around town, and he groomed some of the, like Russian Jack. We had trails by that time at Bartlett High School, even out in Eagle River, and he then would go around town and groom those particular areas. We were grooming even Centennial Camper Park at the time.
Oh, wow, yeah. And he was working for the Muni.
Yeah, he was working for the Muni as a private contractor with a winter contract for grooming the ski trails. And that went through the first day of 1983, and by then the borough had combined, and that was when the borough put a cap on the tax, and they eliminated that particular contract.
Okay.
And that put us in a pickle because the club was to host the first international race that we ever hosted. It was the World Cup, thus when we talk about the World Cup start-finish. And this was in 1983 in March, third week of March of that particular year. And we hosted a race here in Anchorage, or a series of races. And it was an international race. where we had people from Spain, especially Scandinavia and Norway, Sweden, Finland, and so forth. And then the U.S. and Canadians were here. And it was a pretty big deal, especially for skiing, and it was a big deal for the United States, because this, other than the 60 Olympics, this was the biggest race that had been held in the United States.
Ever, in cross-country skiing.
Cross-country skiing.
Yeah.
And we held it in conjunction with Thunder Bay in Canada, and the athletes had a charter plane. Even the Americans got on the plane and flew there for a second series of races.
Did at the time of the World Cup in 1983, I think a lot of us who use the park a lot know where the World Cup start is. But at that time, now when you go to World Cup start, if you're skiing from where the ski stadium is now, you ski up a trail called Elliott's Climb, and then you end up on the top of the hill at World Cup start. But at the time of the World Cup, all of the trails, is my understanding, were on the east side of there. So there was no Elliott's Climb, there was no roller coaster, none of that stuff was there, because that was all, was it still military or?
Yeah, it was still, it was actually, the land was in the process of being transferred, or had just been recently transferred to city property.
Okay.
At that particular time. But no, there were no trails that would have been to the west of the World Cup start finish. And we had two crossings to run those races. We had a at-grade crossing where the bridge is, or approximately where the bridge is, and another one where the upper trunnel is, and it crossed over the top of the road. And for a big race, we had to have people on the road to stop people and shovel where the skiers skied across the road. And it was actually just in preparation for the World Cup, the previous year, we had built the area that's called Berkey's Climb, and it basically went up to the World Cup. And then the other trail that goes down into the S-curves to connect into the lake loops.
Yeah.
And that's the trails that we used for the World Cup that particular year. And it wasn't until 2 years later when in the part of the land transfer between and turning the land over to the city. And all this time there was a question of, we're skiing on portions of the military land. We had the World Cup. And people were looking at it. The military site was still fairly developed down there. The fence was up. Everything was still in place. Even at the World Cup start finish, the headquarters buildings were in place. The only thing we were able to use for the race, they had a motor pool. There we turned into the race headquarters, had a grease pit where you could drive a car in through there, and we threw some plywood over the top of that. And, it was like a four-car garage.
Yeah.
And there was no utilities. The electricity it had been working and connected, but by then it was disconnected. There was no telephone service. We had cooperation with the military for a microwave link, because that was required by the FIS because of the news publicity.
Okay.
And so we had cooperation with the military. They set it up, and we had generators, etc. And that's what we did with our race. But 2 years later,
in 1985, then, 2 years
about
later. Okay.
84, so forth, the city let a contract using some of the money that they got for rehabbing the site. And they hired Dick Mize and John Elliott, who were mostly responsible for building the original trails, to build 3.5 kilometers of trails, because we knew we wanted to turn the site, which is today the main start-finish area that we use today, into the stadium that it is. And that's when we built the roller coaster and Elliott's Climb, as well as we basically used the surface on the south side of the road that goes down by the biathlon range. That's where the sewer line ran. Mm. And that sewer line is still underneath portions of that particular trail. And it ran across. Of course, the biathlon range wasn't where that is. In fact, it was a deep pit, and that's where the military dumped a lot of metal. I can still remember, there were a lot of barbed wire that was rusted and so forth. After the earthquake in 64, there was a lot of damage that occurred out there, and that's where they dumped a lot of stuff. Mm. And, they dumped, and then it was bulldozed over. And today, underneath where the biathlon firing line is, in the area to the south where the timing building is, if you dig down far enough, you're going to be digging in a lot of...
You find some treasures down there.
Treasures. You probably don't even want to find them.
Right. So this is... that. By now we're talking like 1984, 1985, as this area was getting developed. And was there a lot of competition among other... Were there other groups that were interested in this, or was there not really so much?
Oh, yeah. Well, you still had the motocross area. And it was a 365-day... a year operation at that particular time. They close it now in the winter after we lobbied that they didn't need it. There was constant in those days intrusion on the trails, even when we were grooming them and so forth, of ATVs, snow machines. I can remember one time running a high school race, and we had 4 teenagers on motor or snow machines come right down through the start finish there at where the bridge is on the south side of the entrance road, and we had to corral those kids and pull them over until the race was over, and so they could go on their way, because they were a hazard to the kids that were racing. Yeah. But we did have political problems. There was other user groups. As I mentioned, the motocross. The other group that got some property out there at that time were the archers up by the World Cup. They've got an archery range. It's on the north side back in there. Then later in the 90s, 2000, they developed the disc golf activity. Then in the 2000s also, we made an agreement, because the soccer association was looking for a place to run soccer, and they've got an artificial turf field and 8 other soccer fields down there. And it was a logical place to do it.
Yeah.
And it didn't really displace, very many Nordic activities at the time. And
I want to interrupt you one more time to let listeners know that you're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Radio. My name's Adam Verrier. I'm your host, and I'm here with Berkey, or Jim Burkholder, one of the guys that was heavily influential in the development of Kincaid Park, which is the park we're talking about today. The park now, so it was really in the mid-80s that it seems like that the area that used to be the Nike missile site was turned into what it is today. Actually, one other question I wanted to ask you about other users, were there any developers who wanted to turn that into subdivisions out there, or was that not really ever going to happen? Well, was it all sort of park and it was going to
be that way? It was basically for public purposes.
Okay.
And but there was a question at that particular time of the Anchorage area needing a location for prisons. And we look today out at Eagle River and you got the Highland Mountain
Correctional Center
out there. And there were there was some discussion and pressure to turn what is today where the bunker buildings and the chalet is. And certainly if you'd have looked at that site at that particular time,
it had the look.
It looked like a prison.
Yeah.
And so I think the, and this is only my opinion, but I think the lawyers and their Lincolns and Cadillacs would rather have driven out. It was about the same amount of time to drive out to Eagle River, Highland Mountain, and the road was paved.
Okay.
And you couldn't call the entrance road into Kincaid paved. Even Raspberry from Sand Lake was gravel. And it wasn't until really sometime in the later 80s that they paved the road. There was an effort to upgrade facilities by the Nordic Club. We had the first lighted trail system at Kincaid was developed in the late 70s and that was a job for lighted loop at that particular time.
Okay.
They used water conservation funds, I believe, as a grant for building that. And there was, we're talking just as the two governmental agencies, the borough and the city, coming together. And there was a question about when lights ever got turned on. And it wasn't until middle of February they got turned on because nobody had ever appropriated the money for the electricity.
Pay for the electricity, yeah.
So the lights sat there from November to January or 1st of February before it ever got, somebody flipped the switch.
Well, I kind of get the impression that that some of the motivation for developing the area that had been the Nike missile site, some of the motivation for the ski club and for the people that were involved as volunteers to make those things happen, was to establish a kind of a traditional use that that if you could get ski trails in there and people start skiing on them, that it's a lot more likely to remain that way and keep getting used for that purpose rather than some other purpose. I mean, it'd be difficult to put a subdivision in Kincaid Park now.
I think you're correct, and that was the certainly in the early 70s that wasn't our intent because we were building most of the trails at that particular time when area we thought other than the lake area was Kincaid Park, but today. You've got the single track advocates trails there, as I say, the archery, the disc golf, the motocross area. And over the years, at various times, facilities have been upgraded. Most of the money was raised and so forth by the Nordic Club for the trails today are, with the exception of some of the ones that we originally built around the lake and the horseshoe and so forth, which are still effectively only about 8 foot wide, are 18 to 20 feet. Part of the reason for that is that in the grooming world, you can only buy a couple a piston bully or bombardier, and they make these things. PB piston bully 100 is about 8 feet wide.
That's the smallest thing they make.
Smallest thing they make.
Yeah.
And that's effectively what the club uses to groom other areas in the city, like Bartlett and up on the hillside, the Tour of Anchorage Trail, and so forth. And the Kincaid, we had the opportunity to buy a 18, or actually it was a 16-foot wide vehicle or piston bully. And since then, we've got the 18-foot wide tillers, because snow grooming has become a real key to the sport of skiing. Anchorage has probably the more trails for the population, more lit trails for sure. There's over 35 kilometers of lit trails in Kincaid Park if you take and include the Raspberry bike trail from the park entrance to the chalet. Mm. And half of the lights that are up in the park were put up by the Nordic Ski Club, including all the stadium lights in the stadium. Mm. And it was all funded by the club. The lights on the Mize Loop, the lights on the first 3 kilometers, the Leakage. And these were donated by the Miniker and Leakage families as a dedicated ski facility because of the death of a couple of young athletes that died in
their memory,
tragic accidents.
Below the main stadium area where a lot of people go skiing or where they park their car and start skiing, to the north and west, you have the Sisson Trail down there. But that's a relatively new trail, I guess. It's a really popular trail, I think, because it's pretty flat down there. It's pretty relaxing skiing. In fact, I think there's an area that might even be below sea level. Some people say it is.
Well, there's one point that it would be probably, especially with the rising of the oceans, is below sea level.
Hmm. And that's the Sisson Loop.
It's on the Sisson Loop. And the reason it is, it was because the airport, it was even Kincaid Park, where this hole is down there that we ski through, but the airport excavated the gravel to build the north-south runway.
Oh, that's where that came from. Okay.
And most, there's a big area down in the Sisson that is both, the Sisson Trail is built both on airport land, and that's very obvious to people to ski and ski underneath. When you have a 747 landing and you can almost reach up and touch the wingtip.
With your ski pole.
Not quite, but if you were on a giraffe, maybe.
Right.
But because it is the navigation lights reach all the way to the edge of almost the edge of the coastal trail.
And so why was that trail built? This isn't trail.
The basic reason for it was we were going to host the World Masters Championships, and I think this was 82-3, and by the rules, the old folks who race in the World Masters, people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and even some into their 90s, they have a little different regulations as how much climb and fall. And we needed flatter terrain.
Well, we've been we're getting kind of close to the end of the hour before long, and we've been looking back a lot. I have a dangerous question for you because we could probably spend another hour on it, but we only have probably another 5 minutes. But looking forward, you've been involved in the development of this trail system from the start, along with other people like Dick Mize and all the other people that were involved. But starting now, looking forward, is there anything that you think that you'd really like to see at Kincaid Park to make it a park that you like more even than what it is out there right now?
Well, I think, one of the things is that we built a fairly good size parking lot. But when you have just an average a day at Kincaid, like today I skied over, drove the car over by the stadium parking lot there, and I wouldn't say that the parking lot was stuffed full, because when it is, people have to park on the road, which they usually park on the north side of the road and so forth, and they weren't parked there, but that parking lot was pretty full. And so there are events. Yeah.
And it's a Wednesday. This is a Wednesday afternoon.
Yeah, but it's Christmas vacation, so right, you yeah. got... but at any rate, it's even more crowded when you have a big soccer tournament.
Oh,
because right. The soccer tournament, what they have to do is open the gate and let them park on the start-finish area of the Nordic area.
Mm. Yeah, and when it's wet, that's not such a good situation.
That's a bad situation because the area was never meant for in a mud. If it's dry and so forth, it's not a problem, other than it creates more dust and it's hard to keep grass growing on it, so forth. Yeah. But there's, a couple other parking lots that are up at the top of the hill. Before you drop over and can see the stadium on the left and the right. People park on the entrance road into the World Cup start, finish, and so forth. But, there may be somebody may need to look at trying to expand a little better in parking. And I think that there's a case to be made as we have lower snow years, and to expanding a little on the snowmaking. I mean, okay. You have the water source, you have the pumping. It would mean over the years now, since we put it in, we have tried to expand it a little bit by taking the lance guns and running a nozzle and a hose up onto Dark Alley in the last half of roller coaster and, connecting that. But I would look at that area that's uphill from Dark Alley and over towards roller coaster, and there's ways you could do it without having to dig a 10-foot deep trench to bury the pipe.
And perhaps looking forward at the future, the weather prediction for the future, it may be good to get started on making sure that there's snow available to ski on.
I've seen water systems in the east where they did this on a hillside, and as long as you can open a valve at the bottom and drain the pipe, you see. And so you put the pressure in the pipe and the water, and that it's used to make the snow, and you have the faucets, and you run the trail back, and you can put the pipe literally right on the ground and just run it right over the top, the trail right over the top, and then extend the snow making out and perhaps an up trail, and then connect it so that you can make snow on the lower portion of roller coaster.
Okay, right.
And
yeah.
so forth.
Yeah.
And there may be a way to do that over close to on the south side of the biathlon range, because there's a complex of trails in there.
Yeah.
And you could perhaps do that sort of in the same way.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't be nearly as costly as trying to dig a trench 8 to 10 feet deep and burying a special pipe.
Right. Okay. Well, I have one more question for you. We've only got a few seconds left. That is, how often do you use the park, and what do you like most about it? And again, this is so it could go long, but
I like it. One is as I get older, just turned 80, so I ski almost every day that I can. I didn't ski this last weekend when we had the high winds, and I missed a few days when we had a foot of snowdrop. But I'm using the park for both cross-country skiing in the winter, and when the trails dry out, not just the ski trails, but also the single track trails, you know, get on my mountain bike and going over there and riding. And I use the trails to access the Raspberry paved bike trail, which connects me into the coastal trail, and you know, clear downtown. You got the Moose Loop, you know, almost a 50-kilometer loop around Anchorage. There needs to be some planning to try to connect some of these things. There's a very difficult connection between basically Jewel Lake and Campbell Creek.
Yeah.
And the logical thing is a bikeway in front on West 88th in front of Diamond High School that's a dedicated bike trail. Or maybe it's on street, but it'd be safer than what it is today, which is unmarked and unrecognized as the best route to get to the Campbell Creek. Because once you're on Campbell Creek,
you're safe.
You're set.
Yeah.
And the other missing piece is trying to get from Russian Jack Springs over to Tyson Elementary and Ship Creek. They've made an effort in Mountain View bikeways on some of the less traveled streets there. But, you know, the city, if they want to be, you know, and that connects you into the Glen Highway Trail.
Yeah.
And from there, you can go clear to Peters Creek.
Right. And beyond. Well, Berkey, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. You've been listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Adam Verrier. And Berkey, thanks for coming on.
You're welcome. And it's been a pleasure to try to help people understand some of the history of the park.
Yeah. Well, you've been listening to Outdoor Explorer. As I said earlier, my name's Adam Verrier. I've been your host today. I also want to thank Eric Bork. He's the producer. And I'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.